White Aryan Resistance calling. White Aryan Resistance, this is the webmaster. Tuesday, September 15th, 2015. I'm going to step in today and play for you some clips that I found covering different topics. After the clips, I have an excerpt that I'll read from a book that would be in a similar vein of religion, but it will be the Earth's religion. With a scientific basis for it.
A tough new report concludes that the federal government system for defending poor people in court needs to change. The study says judges who are supposed to be neutral arbiters too often are not. NPR's Carrie Johnson has the story.
The report says defense lawyers for the poor who work in the federal court system need more resources to do their jobs. That means money, not just for themselves, but to pay for experts and investigators. Norman Reamer directs the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, which conducted the study.
Having good, fully resourced defense counsel with access to ancillary services is an absolute must in a society that is arresting 14 million people a year.
In an adversary system, lawyers for poor defendants say they need to operate on equal footing with prosecutors. But the study, the first of its kind in more than 20 years, says it's judges who exercise too much control over the process. Bonnie Hoffman, a deputy public defender in Virginia, led the task force.
There are some significant ways that we feel that the federal system is not measuring up, most importantly in the area of independence.
That's because judges are in charge. They have a role in selecting the defense lawyers for the poor clients who appear in court. They act as umpires during a plea hearing or trial. And then those same judges approve or reject the defense lawyer's fee requests. In many cases, the report says, judges cut fees without explanation, and there's no way to appeal. Jerry Morris is a longtime defense attorney in Texas.
It's just not a good situation to have the judge that you're appearing before have that much control over ultimately how you represent your client.
The report says there's no clear solution to that independence problem. But Morris says the courts have launched their own study of the system for representing poor defendants, and he says he hopes judges will take defense lawyers into account. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Big debate in this country over the future of our overcrowded prisons. One of the thorniest issues is the detention of roughly 80,000 Americans in solitary confinement. Many spend years or even decades in isolation. Last month, President Obama posed this question at a meeting of the NAACP.
Do we really think it makes sense to lock so many people alone in tiny cells for 23 hours a day for months, sometimes for years at a time? That is not going to make us safer.
This morning, we're asking another question. How did the U.S. come to rely so heavily on this extreme form of incarceration? North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann reports.
In the yard at Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia, gray-haired men are making their way up to a small stage. A towering stone prison wall rises overhead. One by one, they sit at a scratchy microphone and tell their stories.
Yes, what I remember is being locked up around there on 14 block 23 hours a day.
Yeah.
It wasn't a pleasant stay.
That's Bill Borden, who did time here in the 1960s. He says he was allowed out of his cell 1 hour each day to play softball. Another former inmate, Anthony Goodman, leans forward and talks about the loneliness, the isolation.
This institution here, I thought it would have broke me. You know, this place here really did something to me psychologically.
Eastern State is a museum now, but this is the prison where solitary confinement was pioneered in the U.S. Today's reunion here in Philadelphia is a chance for former inmates to talk about what it meant to do time here.
Because this place would make you go insane if you didn't know how to handle it.
One of the elderly men who takes the microphone is Fred Kellner. He wasn't a prisoner here. He was a psychiatrist charged with looking after the mental health of men like Borden and Goodman. He says he knew conditions at Eastern State were hurting people, but he felt powerless.
I remember being bothered by various situations. You can't do much about it because the most important thing in a prison is control, and that rules. If you expect to change it, you're in for depression.
Here's one of the first things you learn when you study the history of solitary confinement. People have had doubts about isolating inmates for a really long time. The earliest experiments were carried out here at Eastern State in the 1800s.
We're in a cell in cell block 7.
The inmate living in this cell would be in this room for 23 hours a day.
Sean Kelly, director of education, shows me the tiny monastic cells. It looks like a medieval dungeon, but he says at first people really believed that isolating criminals for long periods might help them heal, make them more virtuous. Critics didn't buy it. The British author and activist Charles Dickens, who visited in the 1840s, described long-term isolation as ghastly, a form of torture. Kelly says the people running Eastern State didn't listen. Decade after decade, they kept trying to make the system work.
The officers and the administrators would write about the inmates becoming agitated. They would carry out really extreme physical punishments to maintain silence. They would literally put them in straitjackets, douse them in water in the wintertime and leave them outdoors.
Stories like that led to solitary confinement being widely discredited here in the U.S. and around the world. Beginning in the early 1900s, long-term isolation was used rarely with the most dangerous inmates, and usually only for short periods, a week or two. But Kelly says the idea had woven itself deep in the DNA of American prisons.
It is shocking to see that we've gone back to it, that there are tens of thousands, they say 80,000 people on a given day, living in solitary confinement in the United States. And we're used to talking about this being historical practice, but it has all come back around.
The big revival came in the 1980s and 90s. The drug war sent a tidal wave of inmates surging into state and federal correctional facilities. There were riots, gang violence, and assaults on guards. Prison officials looking for a quick fix started building new isolation wards in prisons, and they also designed an entirely new kind of prison known as a supermax correctional facility. These are separate prisons that function very much like Eastern State Penitentiary did in the 1800s, locking inmates in cells for 23 hours a day with little interaction with guards or other prisoners. Nazgul Ghannouch, with a group called the Sentencing Project, says solitary confinement is now hardwired into the architecture of America's prisons.
Right now there are at least 20 supermax prisons and they hold 20,000 people. In one of the prisons in California, for example, Pelican Bay, half of the prison population, 500 people, have been there for over 10 years.
Some inmates have been confined in solitary for 20, 30, even 40 years at a time. The practice is now such a standard disciplinary tool in the U.S. that even nonviolent inmates are often placed in isolation for months or years at a time.
I think it's very important for prison authorities and for the public to reflect on whether it's humane to subject people to this form of isolation that play havoc with people's sanity.
Juan Mendez is a special investigator on human rights with the United Nations. He's worked extensively on the issue of America's system of solitary confinement. It's common, Mendez says, for prisons in the U.S. to hold young people, inmates with mental illness, and pregnant mothers in long-term isolation.
The psychiatric and medical literature is very clear. Deprivation of meaningful social contact does create pain and suffering.
Studies show that solitary confinement can lead to higher rates of suicide and other forms of mental illness, even in modern prisons where inmates in segregation cells are sometimes allowed radios or televisions. Those findings have led top prison administrators like Greg Markantel in New Mexico to look for new ways to scale it back.
It's very, very easy to overuse segregation. I mean, for a guy like me, it's safe, right? It's safe. If these prisons are quiet, I don't get fired.
In all, a dozen states are looking to reform the way they use solitary confinement. We'll hear more about that tomorrow during Morning Edition. But here's a sign of how hard it might be to shift away from long-term isolation in American prisons. Even as President Obama was condemning the use of solitary confinement, his administration is finishing construction of a new $200 million supermax correctional facility in Illinois. Its hundreds of isolation cells are expected to begin holding inmates next year. For NPR News, I'm Brian Mann.
Honeybee populations have been plummeting for nearly a decade in the U.S., but now two scientists in Washington State are teaming up to help the pollinator, and they're investigating an unusual source for the remedy, mushrooms. Ken Christensen of Here and Now contributor EarthVix has more.
Eric Olson clutches the lid on top of his wooden beehive. He slowly lifts it up and peeks inside.
Wow! Very nice.
Olson has been a beekeeper in eastern Washington for half his life.
Look at that!
He loves spending time with his bees, especially when they're doing well.
These girls are fantastic. They're making honey and they're making babies.
But just months ago, Olson and his team discovered that nearly half the bees in his 18,000 hives were dead. Olson wasn't alone. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says that nearly half of honeybee colonies across the country collapsed in the past year. Big losses have been happening for nearly a decade, and scientists haven't determined what's causing them. More than 60 factors may play a role in collapsing colonies. Factors like pesticides, stress, and loss of habitat.
If we don't find some answer, I am really concerned about whether these little girls will survive.
But one unlikely source of help for the honeybee may be growing close by. Paul Stamets tromps through the underbrush of the forests of western Washington. He spots a mushroom growing out of the side of a tree.
All right. Here's a great mushroom.
Stamets is a pioneer in the study of mushrooms. He snaps the mushroom off the tree, then he wraps it in wax paper to take back to his lab. He'll turn the mushroom into an extract.
I use mycology and the use of fungi to help clean up the environment and improve the immune system of animals, including people. I began to think, you know, I bet you I can do something to help the bees.
Stamets recently partnered with Steve Shepard, a bee expert at Washington State University. They think that fungus might give the honeybee two weapons in a fight against its worst enemy. That's a disease-carrying bug called the varroa mite. Shepard says that varroa mites invade hives, feast on bee blood, and transmit a slew of viruses to their hosts. Outside his lab near the Idaho border, Shepard crouches so he can peer into a stack of wooden bee boxes. He extends his bare hand and plucks a bee from one of the hives. He quickly spots a varroa mite.
You see her?
He bags a few hundred bees from the hive. Back at the lab, he transfers them to little plastic cages. Finally, he fills feeding tubes with a few drops of murky brown juice made from mushrooms. It comes from the lab of Paul Stamets, the mushroom expert who's working with Shepard. They're finding that the mushrooms are reducing viruses in bees. Next, Shepard and Stamets will test a different type of fungus to see if they can attack the mite directly.
It's certainly encouraging so far.
Shepard and Stamets plan to expand both experiments by partnering with commercial beekeepers.
Wow, I'm really tickled with this.
Like Eric Olson.
We just can't seem to get a control on the varroa mite. We've got our fingers crossed.
If the mushroom extract can help fend off varroa mites, Olson says the solution could find its way into beehives across the country. For Here and Now, I'm Ken Christensen.
When Pope Francis visits the U.S. this month, he's expected to speak frankly about immigration reform. He has asked to meet personally with immigrants in New York and Philadelphia, and there's a reason for that. The U.S. Catholic Church needs immigrants. More than a quarter of today's believers in the U.S. were born outside of the country. 15% are children of immigrants. NPR's Tom Gelton has more.
Fifth Street in North Philadelphia is and always has been a working-class corridor. St. Helena Catholic Church, at the corner with Godfrey Avenue, is a massive, no-nonsense granite square. The steps out front are in need of repair.
That building was the original church, and the school was on the next two floors.
84-year-old Sister Marie Albert got her Catholic primary education here back when this was an all-white immigrant community.
When I grew up, I mean, everybody on the street were Catholic, you know. There were very few kids who didn't come here to school. When the parish started, it was German and Irish.
Fifth Street is still largely a newcomer neighborhood, but St. Helena now serves Hispanics, Asians, and Africans.
May Almighty God have mercy on us, forgive us our sins, and bring us to everlasting life. Lord, have mercy.
Presiding at Mass on this weekday morning at St. Helena is Father Gardy Villerson. He's from Haiti. Most of the 100 or so worshipers attending today are Hispanic or Asian.
Let us pray.
About 200 Vietnamese families worship at this church. The singing of the liturgy this morning is led by a 13-year-old Vietnamese-American boy, Adrian Pham.
Alleluia,
Alleluia. Alleluia.
Only a handful of U.S.-born white parishioners are on hand. Across the Northeast United States, many of the Catholic parishes established years ago by European immigrants have closed because of declining membership. For a while, it appeared St. Helena might join them. Mary Black has been a member here for more than 40 years, from when it was packed every Sunday with people like herself to when it started to empty out.
I remember one day sitting in church and feeling like the void of lots of people moving out, and that scary feeling of transition, like, what's going to happen? And then they came.
Masses in Vietnamese and Spanish were added to the schedule. The number of worshipers grew. The parish survived.
I really think this church would be shuttered if it wasn't for the Vietnamese community and other immigrants.
Cúi xin Chúa sương soi cho chúng con được biết việc phải làm, việc làm xin Chúa.
8 men from the committee that plans Vietnamese activities at St. Helena open this evening meeting with a prayer. They're led by Father Joseph Trinh, the senior priest at the church and president of the Federation of Vietnamese Catholics in the United States. They're here to discuss the Pope's visit to Philadelphia and how to handle all the Vietnamese Catholics coming to see him.
But these men also show up at the church whenever volunteers are needed. Dave Nguyen says he knows St. Helena was built decades ago by European immigrants, but he says it's now up to new Americans like himself to maintain the parish. The old ones are mostly gone.
They left behind, and we are immigrant Vietnamese and Hispanics, Africa or Jamaica, it's everybody here. We do not have the opportunity to build the church, but we have the opportunity to upkeep the church.
The immigrant influx nationwide has revitalized Catholic churches in particular. Mostly it's Hispanics, but Asians are moving up fast. William D'Antonio is a professor of sociology at Catholic University.
We're in the twilight of the white, ethnic, European Catholic Church.
No wonder the Catholic Church today is a big supporter of immigration reform. Immigrants are the church's future.
Within 40 years, this will be such a colorful church. We could be a model for the world of how Catholics from all over know how to live together.
In fact, newly intermingling cultures can bring conflict. But at St. Helena, Mary Black and other longtime parishioners say that as they get to know these immigrant newcomers, they appreciate what they bring to the congregation.
The warmth of the Spanish people, to me, is so heartfelt. The devoutness of the Vietnamese always inspires me. The folks that come from Africa with their dress of, I forget what they're called, but Indians that come in saris, it's just an amazing experience.
Mary's friend Anita Repsch, a St. Helena member for 58 years, often attends Mass with her immigrant friends.
We go to a Mass that's Spanish or Vietnamese, and because our Mass is so structured, we can follow it and know what's happening. It doesn't have to be in our language. Basically, we can pray together no matter what language.
We can pray together. What longtime St. Helena parishioners have learned, and exactly what Pope Francis, the first from Latin America, wants to promote when he visits this country later this month. Tom Gelton, NPR News.
Nick Toshes has written a new novel that Publishers Weekly calls unflinchingly blasphemous, mirthfully vulgar, and ultimately brilliant. It's about a small-time con man of ancient times who steals, swears, drinks, goes whoring, and leaves town. But a Roman aristocrat named Gaius Falconius sees commercial possibilities in this drifter. They hit the road together, and the man becomes known as Jesus Christ. Nick Toshes' new novel is called Under Tiberius, and Nick Toshes, who has been called the Dark Prince of American literary fiction, joins us from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
So the premise of the book is it's a newly discovered memoir, right?
That is the premise, yes.
So, well, tell us how that comes about.
It's set up as a forgotten, lost manuscript that was not meant to be read by anyone except the author's grandson.
There's a stunning scene in which a man comes to Jesus and says, "Help my daughter, she is blind." And he does. I won't read your own words back to you, but Jesus tells her father she's blessed. She sees what we cannot. The Lord has given her this gift. Your child is special and deserving of adoration. I was deeply moved.
I was very, very gratified that certain scenes such as that one did come to me, as well as the nastier stuff.
Well, as soon as he's done delivering this beautiful words of encouragement to the father, he says something utterly vile.
yes.
which I guess it's hard for us to repeat, but it suggests that Jesus didn't mean a word of it. But is that part true? Is it possible to mean the words? But I mean, I thought after reading the scene, maybe Jesus doesn't mean it when he says something flip and vulgar.
It's part of human nature. We might say something to console or encourage another, not really believing a word of it, and yet it will have the intended effect. And on the other hand, we're basically capable of saying anything depending on the mood.
I think you're going to be asked this question a lot as you speak about the book over the next few weeks. Why write a book like this?
A book like this. One of the primary motivations in a lot of my thinkings and a lot of my books has been the question of, did man invent the concept, the dichotomy of good and evil, before he invented the gods, or did he invent the gods first and then pronounce good and evil through them? I think I wanted to push people to actually look at the fact that the idea of God has never been a force for good in this world, but only for evil. And it's only been born out of weakness and resulted in bloodshed, mayhem, lies, theft.
Do you really believe that, Mr. Tosches?
Yes, I do.
No good whatsoever?
Well, could you give me an instance?
I have been around the world in a lot of different wars and scenes of savagery. And in, I believe, all of them, you will find very selfless priests and nuns trying to help people.
I agree with you 100% completely and without reservation. I am saying that those same good human people would be behaving the same way without a God to tie it onto.
Can I ask some questions about you, the writer, Nick Tosches?
Sure.
You're no Iowa Writers Workshop writer, are you?
No, I'm not. As a matter of fact, I've never been to a writer's workshop.
I've read that you were once a snake hunter?
For a few weeks, yes. Dr. Haas's Serpentarium, which no longer exists down in the outskirts of the Everglades south of Miami. It was then the world's largest producer of anti-venom, which was gotten from the venom from poisonous snakes by milking them. Mm-hmm. I was a snake hunter who was deathly afraid of snakes. I'm from Newark, New Jersey. that was one of my early attempts to make a living.
Well, back to your book.
Sure.
Toward the close of the book, Gaius says, "Only the weak, the meek, and wretched of the earth need the palliative of hope." Don't we all need hope?
I think we do. And if there is a God, I think the greatest gift he instilled in every human being is delusion. And that is what hope is. That we who do not have a cup of coffee today will have one tomorrow. So it basically drives us forward.
Nick Tosches, his new book, Under Tiberius. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for letting me talk a while.
Earthing by Clinton Ober and Stephen T. Sinatra, M.D., along with Martin Zucker. Forward by the James L. Oshman, Ph.D., author of Energy Medicine, The Scientific Basis. Earthing at a glance. What is earthing? Earthing involves coupling your body to the Earth's eternal and gentle surface energies. It means walking barefoot, outside, and or sitting, working, or sleeping, while connected to a conductive device that delivers the natural healing energy of the earth into your body. For more than 10 years, thousands of people around the world have incorporated earthing into their daily routines. The results have been documented, and they are extraordinary. What isn't earthing? You are not, in any sense, being electrocuted. Earthing is among the most natural and safest things you can do. What happens? Your body becomes suffused with negatively charged free ions abundantly present on the surface of the earth. Your body immediately equalizes to the same electric energy level or potential as the earth. What do you feel? Sometimes a warm, tingling sensation and other feelings of ease and well-being. Will you feel better? Usually yes, and often rapidly. The degree of improvement varies from person to person. The important thing is to make earthing a long-term addition to your daily routine and to do it as much as possible to gain maximum benefits. When earthing is stopped, symptoms tend to slowly return. What does earthing do? Observations and research indicate the following benefits from earthing. We expect many more to emerge with ongoing studies. Diffuses the cause of inflammation and improves or eliminates the symptoms of many inflammation-related disorders. Reduces or eliminates chronic pain. Improves sleep in most cases. Increases energy. Lowers stress. And promotes calmness in the body by cooling down the nervous system and stress hormones. Normalizes the body's biological rhythms. Thins the blood and improves blood pressure and flow. Relieves muscle tension and headache. Lessens hormonal and menstrual symptoms. Dramatically speeds healing and helps prevent bed sores. Reduces or eliminates jet lag. Prevents the body against potentially health-disturbing environmental electromagnetic fields, or EMFs. Accelerates recovery from intense athletic activity. I'll mention a few of the studies showing this earthing is beneficial to the human body. William Amelou, D.C., president of the International Academy of Clinical Thermography, performed earthing studies on 20 patients with a variety of complaints, including chronic myofascial pain syndrome, muscular strains, ligamentous sprains, peripheral neuropathies, carpal tunnel syndrome, and inflammatory joint condition, along with Lyme disease and chronic sinusitis. The subjects were either grounded with conductive electrode patches in his office or slept on grounded bed pads at home. The results showed, through dramatic pictures, a major and rapid impact on inflammation and pain. Please refer to the color images showing some of these changes. Some patients experienced improvement in just one session. Within 2 to 4 weeks of 2 to 3 half-hour treatments weekly, up to 80% improvement occurred in the cases that were followed up. With ongoing grounding over weeks and months, the patients continued to get relief, feel better, and in some cases their symptoms vanished altogether. Quote, the moment your foot touches the earth, or as you connect to the earth through a wire, your physiology changes, James Oshman says. An immediate normalization begins, and an anti-inflammatory switch is turned on. People stay inflamed because they never connect with the earth, the source of free electrons, which can neutralize the free radicals in the body that cause disease and cellular destruction. The umbrella effect of earthing. The Applewhite study showed the protective effect of earthing against environmental electrical fields. Another way to think of this is as an umbrella effect. Let's look for a moment at the electrical properties of the Earth's surface and the way the Earth's energy influences our biology. In his classic lecture on physics from the early 1960s, Nobel Prize physicist Richard Feynman described the Earth's subtle energies. The surface, as we have seen, has an abundance of electrons which give it a negatively electrical charge. If you're standing outside on a clear day wearing shoes or standing on an insulating surface like wood or vinyl floor, There is an electrical charge of some 350 volts between the earth and the top of your head, if you're 5 feet 9 inches tall. Keep in mind it is about 0 volts at ground level. You might ask, is there really a voltage difference of 350 volts from head to toe? Why don't I get shocked when I go outside? The answer is that air is relatively a poor conductor and has virtually no electrical current flow. If you're standing outside in your bare feet, you are earthed. Your whole body is in electrical contact with the earth's surface. Your body is a relatively good conductor. Your skin and the earth's surface make a continuous charged surface with the same electrical potential. Also notice in the drawing on the right that the charged area is pushed up and away from your head if you are grounded. Any object in direct contact with the earth, a person, dog, or a tree creates this shielding effect. The object is essentially residing within the protective umbrella of the earth's natural electrical field. This protective phenomenon also occurs inside your house or office if you are connected to the earth with an earthing device like a bed pad or a grounding pad under your feet by the computer. In 2003, electrophysiologists Chevalier and Maury at the California Institute for Human Science investigated the impact of earthing on nervous system function. 58 healthy adults participated in the randomized double-blind experiment involving a series of sophisticated brain and muscle measurements. In individual sessions, a conductive adhesive electrode patch was placed on the sole of each participant's foot while seated comfortably in a recliner. The patches were connected to a wire leading outside through a door. Half the participants were actually grounded, that is, the wire was connected to a ground rod, and the other participants were not grounded. They were similarly patched, but the wires were not connected outside to the rod. The individuals were then monitored first for a half hour pre-test baseline period, and then immediately for another half hour when they were either grounded or sham grounded. The sham group served as what researchers refer to as control. The purpose was to make sure the documented effects were real and not due to people just sitting and relaxing in a comfortable chair. It was double blind. Neither the researchers nor the group assigned knew what was real or shammed grounding. In this study, EMG electrodes were placed on the big shoulder muscles on each side of the neck, the trapezius muscles. The EEG and EMG readings showed the grounding significantly influenced the electrical activity of the brain and muscles, even within a mere half hour. In fact, dramatic changes were recorded almost instantly within 2 seconds of earthing. In the brain, there was an overall decrease in activity at all frequencies, with a crisp change showing on the left side, the one associated with thinking. Thus, earthing appears to calm down the busy mind. As far as muscles were concerned, earthing produces 2 intriguing results. Participants with a high level of tension showed a decrease in muscle tension on both sides. Individuals with little or no muscle tension showed an increase in tension. The results suggest that grounding reestablishes a normal level of tension. The finding paralleled the effect of an earlier cortisol study in which a normalization of the stress-related cortisol level was seen. The grounded subjects, but not the ungrounded ones, showed large and very slow oscillations depending on the individual. This type of oscillation has never been seen before in physiology research. Keep in mind the body operates electrically, including your muscles. Nerve impulses instruct muscle fibers to contract. The contractions naturally generate electricity and small mechanical vibrations, both of which produce fluctuating frequencies of electrical potential at the surface of the skin. This is the electric noise that the EMG measures. An oscillation, or a slow vibration, means the contractions generate electricity in a more rhythmic pattern. An analogy would be to compare people walking randomly in a crowd without any particular order versus a military unit marching in unison. The unit is much more coherent than a random crowd. The influence of earthing on muscles suggests more orderly and efficient activity. There are two last research articles I wanted to mention. The book is paperback, and it is a very easy read and very interesting. It's science and nature combined. Highly recommended. You can get it at the library. I'll give you the name again in a minute. The experiment I'm going to mention involved taking a drop of blood before and after 40 minutes of grounding via electrode patches and then examining the fresh unstained blood under a dark field microscope. These microscopes divert light through the optical system so the details appear light against a dark background. The pictures shocked both the author and all his guests. And the cardiologist, Stephen Sinatra. The after-grounding pictures show that the people's blood dramatically changed within a short period of time after the individual is in contact with the earth. Specifically, there were considerably fewer formations of red blood cells associated with clumping and clotting. The blood appeared to be thinner. To all of us, the results suggested that individuals with heart disease and inflammatory thick blood, typical in cardiovascular disease and diabetes, may reap huge health benefits from simply earthing themselves on a regular basis. From a cardiology standpoint, if you can thin the typical ketchup-like blood of heart patients and people with diabetes in the direction of a consistency of wine, as our simple experiment showed, you remove a colossal risk factor for heart attack and stroke. Blood is thicker than water is an old saying expressing the importance of family ties, but in the medical world, you don't want thick blood. Earthing may be a natural way to keep it nice and thin. Cardiologists use the term viscosity to determine blood thickness. Blood viscosity, an overlooked element in blood tests, has become an emerging major marker for identifying the risk of arterial disease. The thicker your blood, the slower it flows through your circulatory system to bring oxygen and vital nutrients to the cells of your body, and the greater of the risk of forming clots. Coumadin is a widely used medication for thinning the blood and helping prevent clotting. Because of the earthing's effect on blood viscosity, individuals taking Coumadin should first talk to their doctor before grounding. This would also indicate that people that find that taking aspirin when they feel a sickness or a cold coming on, some people do that because it does thin the blood. The earthing would also do the same thing without having to take the aspirin, which can cause a lot of different side effects and has been proven not to be good for your body or your liver. The last study that was done was at the Tour de France. This was 2005 Tour de France. The author was asked to bring the earthing equipment, the electrodes, to the Tour de France team to help them because it's such a grueling race and a lot of injuries occur. So I quote, "We also applied earthing along with other treatments to accelerate tissue repair and wound healing from injuries sustained during the competition. The results were phenomenal. The cyclist recovered much faster. The most dramatic case involved a cyclist in the 2005 Tour who suffered severe lacerations to his upper right arm after crashing through the rear window of a support car that had stopped abruptly. He managed to make it to the finish line. We immediately received aggressive medical treatment, and he was taken to a hospital for stitches. When I saw him on the team bus right after the day's tour, he had shock written all over his face. His jersey and riding shorts were bloody. His arm had been tightly bandaged to stop the bleeding. When the bandages were removed, you could actually see the tendons and bones through the torn flesh. It looked like somebody had chopped up his arm with a carving knife. Later at the hotel, we saw extensive stitches on his upper arm, as well as elbow, hand, and chin. He had a large purple bruise on his leg, as if someone had hit him with a lead pipe. The team had serious reservations about whether he could continue in the tour because of the extent of his injuries. I asked for 12 hours, basically overnight, to try and help him heal enough to continue racing. I knew that earthing could make a big difference. Everybody agreed it was worth a shot as long as he wasn't in danger of hurting himself further. So I applied multiple grounded electrodes to his arm and leg, and he slept grounded that night, as he had throughout the competition. When he awoke the next day, there wasn't nearly the pain, redness, soreness, or swelling he had the night before. He didn't seem nearly as bad off as would normally be expected. He felt up to going out that day and racing. I took the patches off him, gave him additional care with other techniques. I taped up his bruised leg, he was rebandaged, and off he went to race that day's stage. It turned out that he was indeed able to put in a full day's ride and perform his role for the team. The other cyclists were overjoyed. He ultimately finished the competition and contributed to the team victory. To an outsider, his recovery was nothing less than miraculous. In my experience with earthing, this kind of response is not surprising anymore. In many instances, I have seen an absence of what we regard as normal inflammatory response. When individuals are grounded, injuries lack much, and I mean much, of the typical degree of pain and redness. Tissue repair is accelerated. At the end of the 2005 tour, the team director asked me about the condition of the riders. "They're doing great," I said. "What about tendonitis?" he asked. "Cyclists have a high incidence of tendon inflammation in their legs because of the prolonged and intense strain they put themselves through." "It wasn't a problem," I said. "Anybody sick?" he asked. "No, everybody's good," I answered. He shrugged and said, "Incredible." Now, the title of the book is Earthing, the Most Important Health Discovery Ever, by Clinton Ober. Clinton Ober, O-B-E-R. Stephen T. Sinatra, M.D., he's a cardiologist, and Martin Zucker. This book was printed, I got it at the library. Printed paperback 2010. And you can also go to the website and get that. The Earthing Institute, www.earthinginstitute.net, earthinginstitute.net. This website provides information for obtaining earthing devices, tips on staying earthed in any situation. One thing I do want to point out is that earthing is absolutely free. You do not have to use any type of electronic equipment to do earthing. The book and the website will explain it, but basically, walking in bare feet on unfinished concrete, that means it's not painted, and or on the earth, direct earth, grass, sand, the beach is the best because moisture improves the conductivity of the feet to the earth. So walking in moist sand at the beach or moist earth by using a squirt bottle, you can spray your feet if you're out in the concrete, and or damp grass. You don't have to actually walk in it, though walking combines exercise along with the earthing. So you're getting two for for the price of one, and you can also sit. You've got anybody in a walker, or a wheelchair, anybody in a wheelchair, or someone who is not able to walk or limited on their walking. They can sit with their feet out on the earth, just spray some water on their feet if the ground is not moist. And the longer that it is done, the more effect for the good that you get for your body. That's it for today. Hopefully you enjoyed this information, and I'll try and get on more often to do some other interesting stories.